important operatives of the Central Intelligence Agency working inside Russia. The message provided the American team with their first break in the Green Band investigation. It consisted of just 15 words. Ritz Hotel, London. Thursday morning. $2 billion. Stolen securities to be exchanged. Green Band. Chapter 42. It was probably a dream, and a very bad one. He was standing in an unfamiliar room whose walls met the ceiling at angles that would have been impossible in anything other than dream geometry. There was a door halfway open, and a pale light, the color of pearl, created a slat of dull color. A shadow moved into the pearl-colored light and stood there just beyond the door. He knew, without even having to look, that the figure was Nora. He wanted to move forward, to step out of the room. He wanted to see Nora and hold her, but something held him in place. Something kept him rooted to the floor. He cried her name aloud. And then, a bell was ringing, and he imagined it rang in Nora's hand. Disturbed, sweating, Carol sat upright. He rubbed his eyes, swung his legs over the side of the rumpled covers on his bed. And then he realized that the bell was real. Someone was ringing the doorbell, and this was the sound his dream had absorbed. He wandered from the bedroom. He squinted into the spy hole of the Manhattan apartment he'd once shared with Nora. Who is it? He could see nothing except swirling blackness where the hallway had definitely been last night. Years before, he'd lucked into the West Side apartment, a sprawling three-bedroom with river views. The apartment was still rent-controlled at $479 a month, an impossible bargain. After Nora died, Carol had decided to hold on to the place and use it nights when he worked late in the city. Who is it? Who's out there? Doorbell goddamn rang itself, or was he still dreaming? Whoever was out in the apartment house hallway didn't seem to want to answer. Carol reached back for his Magnum. Arch Carroll finally unlocked the Siegel, but he left the heavy link chain secure. He swung the front door open about 4 inches, and the chain snapped against the sturdy wooden jamb. Caitlin Dillon was peering in at him through the doorway crack. She looked frightened. Her eyes were hollow and dark. Chapter 43. I couldn't sleep. What time is it? I'm embarrassed to say it's before 5. It's about 5:20, okay? In the morning? Please laugh at this or something. Oh, God. I'm going... She suddenly turned away. Hold it. Wait. Hey, stop walking. She half turned at the elevator. Her hair was wind-blown and her cheeks were flushed, like she'd been riding horses in Central Park. Come on in. Please, come in and talk. Please. Inside his apartment, Carol whisked clean the kitchen table and he made coffee. Caitlin sat down and twisted her long fingers together nervously. She opened a box of cigarettes and lit one. When she spoke, her voice was husky, slightly unfamiliar. I've been smoking for hours, which is uncharacteristic of me. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't stop pacing around. All that information about the stolen securities kept spinning through my head, Arch. Carol shook the last remnants of the bad dream from his mind, jerking himself into the present. Green Band's moving, only we can't figure out the direction they're taking. That's one thing that bothers me, Caitlin said. And then I start to wonder how much has been stolen and how far this whole incredible thing goes. I calculated an amount in the region of a couple hundred million, but God knows how much more has actually disappeared. She sighed, crushing her cigarette impatiently. Also, I'm still really ticked off at not being invited to that meeting in Washington. Do they honestly think I've got nothing to contribute? Carol had never seen her in this frame of mind. It was like watching her from a whole new set of angles. She was angry, she was worried, and she seemed temporarily confused. Her usual business world professionalism couldn't help her now. She was reduced to asking questions which neither of them could answer. Suddenly, Caitlin Dillon wasn't quite so untouchable. Around 5:15, they made Sara Lee Danishes, the only moderately edible items in Carol's kitchen. "When I was 13 or so, I actually won a bake-off." This was at an Ohio County Fair, Caitlin admitted as she pulled the Danishes out of the oven. They moved out to a windowed nook which overlooked the river and the New Jersey Palisades. One whole wall of the room was covered with 35mm pictures of the kids. A single, fading picture was of Carol as an Army sergeant in Vietnam. He'd taken down the last pictures of Nora only a few months before.
Tremendous.
He licked sticky crumbs off his index and middle fingers. Caitlin's eyes rolled back into her forehead. "I'm not impressed with your kitchen supplies, Arch. Your cupboard's stocked with 4 bottles of beer, a half jar of Skippy peanut butter. Haven't you heard? The contemporary man in New York is a gourmet cook." Maybe her boyfriends were, Carol thought to himself. None of the contemporary men Carol knew could cook anything much more complicated than tomato soup. "What can I tell you? I'm basically an ascetic. Skippy peanut butter happens to be cholesterol-free." A different kind of look crossed Caitlin's face right about then. A private joke smile? Carol wasn't sure he'd read it correctly. Was she laughing at him now? Then a quick, reassuring smile came that was warm and even more comfortable. "I think we're going to need at least an hour," she said mysteriously. Uninterrupted time. Phone off the hook, seclusion and quiet. "You didn't have any big plans for the morning, I hope." "Just sleep." Boring, also not very ascetic. Carol shrugged his broad shoulders, his eyes burned with curiosity. "I'm a boring person. Daddy, sometimes mom of 4. Straight job with the government, occasional terrorist contact." There was a dense silence as he and Caitlin walked out of the windowed den. They cleared their throats almost at the same moment. Caitlin reached for him, and then they were lightly, just barely, holding hands. Carol was suddenly very aware of her perfume, the shh-shh of her jeans, the silhouette of her profile. "This is one of the more impressive New York apartments I've been in. I really didn't expect this. All the hominess. The charm." "What did you expect? Hunting rifles on the wall?" "Actually, I sew. I can knit. I do iron-on patches for 4 little kids." Caitlin had to smile at Carol again. It was the first time he'd seen this particular smile. Irony, but also nice warmth were glowing in her eyes at the same time. He felt like they crossed some barrier, made some slightly more solid connection. He wasn't sure what it was, though. They started to kiss and touch each other lightly in the narrow hallway. They kissed gently at first. Then the kiss became harder, with urgency and strength on Caitlin's part. They kissed all the way to the front bedroom where morning light was flooding the room. Huge, curtainless windows faced onto the Hudson, which was a flat, slate blue lake that morning. "Caitlin, is this why?" "It is really wise. It doesn't mean the end of the world, you know. It's just one morning. I promise not to get hurt. If you do." She put a finger to Carol's lips, softened the blow of her last statement. She then lightly kissed the back of her own finger. "I have one small favor. Don't think about anything for 10 minutes or so. No Ohio jokes either, okay?" Carol nodded. She was smart about this kind of thing, too. A little scary smart. She'd been here before. "I won't get hurt. Don't you get hurt." "All right. Whatever you say can be the official rule." For a moment, they sat together hugging on the low-slung, quilt-covered double bed. Then they very slowly began to undress. A shivery draft slithered in from the casement windows. The cold air seemed to blow right through the tall, black-framed window pane. Carol was completely, physically and spiritually entranced, also frightened. He hadn't been with anybody for over 3 years. There hadn't been anything like this for so very long. He felt a little guilty, automatically comparing Caitlin with Nora, though he didn't want to. Caitlin's hands had the lightest imaginable touch, extraordinary control and gentleness as she tugged off his trousers. He felt everything beginning to relax inside. Her fingers were like elegant feathers over his upper back, tickling, dusting his neck. Then Caitlin's palms, rotating in easy circles, into his temple, gently pulling on the curls of his dark hair. Carol remembered that he was ticklish down both sides of his stomach. He had been since he was a little kid. More feathery fingers, teasing Carol up and down the insides of his legs, onto the balls of his feet, his toes, his soles. Then everything was moving slightly faster, up another notch in tempo. His body suddenly, involuntarily spasmed. Jesus Christ! Caitlin was doing some unexpected things to him. She blew softly on the insides of her hands. She cupped warm fingers over his eyelids, then over his ears. She spoke in a voice that was nearly as gentle and sensual as her touch. This is called a thrill massage. Believe it or not, it was the fad at Little Oberlin College. Yeah? You're good at it. Aw, gee, blush. Wild youth in long-forgotten Midwestern cornfields. He was beginning to like her. Maybe an awful lot. He didn't know if he should, if this truly was wise. She lightly brushed his legs again, his upper back again, neck, scrotum. Only much faster, even lighter now, turning him into jelly, no container. There was no real impression of fingers he was noticing. Quite amazing. More like the softest combs of air. How had she gotten this good? A little unbelievable in a way, being who she was. Who was she, really? Her face came down very close then. Smile for the camera, Arch. Faint smiling whisper from Caitlin. My heart is pure, but my mind is occasionally kinky. At some time, somewhere in all of the light touching, brushing, tickling, Caitlin had taken her jeans and blouse off. She still wore pink underpants, wool knee socks. Her breasts had the loveliest, delicate, shell-pink nipples. They were hard now, totally aroused. She touched one erect nipple, then the other to the head of Carol's penis. She was a masterpiece, Carol couldn't help thinking, completely filling his eyes. Carol remembered what she'd said before in the breakfast nook. It made him smile a little now, almost laugh out loud. We're going to need at least an hour. There was no longer such a thing as time. No green band urgencies existed right now. Carol had the comfortable, wonderful idea that he trusted Caitlin Dillon. He almost completely trusted her. How could he so easily trust Caitlin already? Tell me all about yourself. Whatever comes out. No editing, okay, Carol? To the continuing rhythm of her fingers, to the slight crooning of bed springs, to dancing morning sunbeams, Carol spoke the truth, as he knew it. Whole life story, about 30 seconds. As a little kid, I always wanted to play for the Yankees, maybe for the football Giants. Son of a cop, honest, poor cop. Irish Catholic family from the West Bronx. That's my youth. Notre Dame, law school at Michigan State, then drafted. Four absolutely terrific kids. Kind of a perfect marriage until Nora passed away. That's Middle American for she died. I'm a very different person when I'm with my kids. Childlike and free. Maybe a little retarded. Boy, that's very nice. Yeah, right there. Ohio, huh? What else? You were telling me your life story. Reader's Digest condensed version. Oh, yeah. I have this recurring problem. Big problem. With them. Who's them? Arch Carol suddenly felt a sharp twist of tension. Not now. He made it go away. Just them. Ones who make all the most important decisions. ones who rob people without caring one way or the other. On Wall Street, down in Washington, ones who trade terrorist murderers for innocent kidnapped business people. The ones who kill people of brain cancer, the bad guys, as opposed to us. Caitlin gently kissed Carol's curly brown hair. She kissed his cauliflower ear. She finally found his mouth, which tasted very nice, she thought. Fresh and clean and sweet. I don't like them, either. I think I like you. I think I like us. Please like me a little. All I can do is try, Caitlin. You're beautiful. You're witty. You seem to be nice as hell. I'll try to like you. Now me. Your turn, too, Caitlin whispered. This and that, the next thing. Really soft, Arch. Well, you, that name's more like the verb. To Arch. Anybody ever call you Archie? Not more than once. Tough guy, she purred. I'm a street cop. Carol slowly rose onto his hands, then his knees. He was very hard, almost painfully hard. At his first touch, Caitlin tightened her stomach. Then she slowly let herself relax. She tightened the abdominal muscles in her stomach, then let herself relax again. Her breathing was controlled, holding for several seconds. Her pulse was slow. A runner's. Where did she learn all this stuff? Not in Ohio. Not at Oberlin College. Her eyes closed. Such smiling eyes. She was easy to be with. Carol's pulse was thumping so damn hard. He never in his life held off orgasm this long, never felt excited in quite this way. His head grew light. Please wait, okay? Caitlin whispered to him, her body spasmed lightly. Trying. Just wait, Arch. Carol's brain was burning up. His body was a million raw, exposed nerves as he floated down, floated down, floated down. Finally, he went inside Caitlin. Her eyes slowly, very slowly, shut. Her mouth opened, wider and wider, an unbelievably soft, delicately pink mouth. Her face was so surprisingly sweet in passion. She seemed to be smiling all the time. Then Caitlin's eyes slipped open, looked at him, and she made him feel so good. Wanted again, necessary to somebody. Hi there, Arch. Nice to have you here. By yourself. Nice to be had. They moved faster together. Her dark hair slowly danced backward and forward. Her curls spread across the pillow, brushed, flowed majestically across his face, hid her eyes. Carol arched dramatically and nearly fell over backwards. Impossible acrobatic position. He spasmed, shuddered, called out her name so loudly it embarrassed him. Caitlin! Completely new feelings were coming so fast. Again. Caitlin! He felt as if she knew him, instantly saw through his defenses, his poses. Finally, somebody. Jesus. When it was over, when it was finally, finally over, neither of them could move. Nothing anywhere in the universe could move. Not ever again. Chapter 44. Thomas X. O'Neill, chief of U.S. Customs at Shannon Airport, Ireland, walked with most of his body weight ponderously thrown back on his boot heels. As he walked, his toes splayed out as if he were wearing ill-fitting bedroom slippers. His size 47 waist protruded obscenely, as did his customary 9-inch Cuban cigar. Chief O'Neill looked like an unflattering caricature of Churchill, and he couldn't have cared less. He had a public image, and he enjoyed it. He didn't give a good goddamn what anyone thought. At 12 noon, O'Neill casually waddled across the frozen gray tarmac toward North Building 3 at the Irish airfield located outside of Dublin. As he walked, O'Neill could smell fresh peat settling in the air. Nothing quite like the blessed aroma, he was thinking. At the same moment, he looked up and saw a majestic 727 just gliding in through a blowing fog from America. 7 years before, he'd come over from New York himself. He never ever planned to return to that syphilitic rat's asshole either. He had even tried to alter his accent and speech patterns so that he'd sound Irish. It was a ludicrous attempt, and he came off sounding like a ham in some third-rate touring company doing George Bernard Shaw. Inside Building 3, there were hundreds of various-sized wooden crates marked with the usual faded corporate logos. A carrot-haired Irish inspector stood with a red marker and clipboard beside a bare wooden desk right at the center of the cluttered warehouse room. "This the lot of it, Liam?" Chief O'Neill asked the inspector. "This Pan Am 310 from this morning?" "Aye, sir. These particular boxes are from the Catholic Charities in New York. Clothes and such for sending up north. Giving us all their old Calvin Klein, their Jordache jeans, so they are. Look very smart and chic on the provos, I'll bet." Chief Inspector O'Neill grinned broadly. He was trailing grand clouds of smoke all around the freight inspection shack. He both chewed and puffed his Cubans to get his money's worth. Thomas O'Neill had been born and raised in New York's Yorkfield section. He'd worked as an inspector at Kennedy International nearly 9 years before his fortuitous transfer as head of the U.S. service at Shannon. Before that, O'Neill had been a master sergeant in general supply in Vietnam. Over in Nam, he'd managed to look like a junior Patton instead of Churchill. He was also Vet 28. "Looks fine and dandy to me, lad. Let the boys load it up for the trip north. 50 new clothes for women and children, a very good cause." Chief Inspector O'Neill laughed for no apparent reason. He was in a chipper mood that afternoon. And why not? Had he not just succeeded in getting $1.4 billion worth of freshly stolen stock certificates and securities into Western Europe? Chapter 45. 4 a.m. Why were there suddenly so many 4 a.m.s crowding into his life? Carol wondered. For a foggy moment, he was disoriented. He felt like a man on a treadmill sent spinning off into space, where time zones collapsed, where clocks had no meaning. This, he remembered, was the heart of London. But that didn't matter because 4 a.m.s were mostly alike, a bleached-out, dour hour of the day when cities slept and only cops and criminals wandered around, following some curious ancient chronology all their own. Everything always started as the same intense four-bell alarm emergency, but nothing ever happened after you broke every imaginable speed and safety law getting to the supposed crime scene. Not right away, anyway. First, you waited. Almost always you waited. And waited. You drank drums of bitter black coffee. You smoked countless stale cigarettes. You paid your full dues every single time on a police case. His fingers gently massaged his warm, throbbing temple. He felt weirdly numb as he watched Caitlin, who catnapped across the room in the stuffy Ritz Hotel. For the past few hours, Caitlin had been drifting in and out of a restless sleep. Her pale lips parted slightly as she swallowed. The scooped hollow in her throat made her look sweet and vulnerable. Her legs were neatly curled under her, like a folding pin inside. They'd been on emergency alert for 20 straight hours now. They were one of several police financial teams which had been rushed to London following Margarita Krupchuk's warning transmission from inside Russia. It was exactly like the unpleasantly tense and chaotic Wall Street deadline on December 4th. Nothing had happened when it was supposed to happen. No Russians with an extraordinary $120 million payment. No Green Band with their enormous pilfered hoard of stocks and bonds. First, you wait. How in hell did they manage to make contact with Francois Montserrat? Montserrat is unknown, virtually without a face. Damned fellow's an enigma to every intelligence agency I know of in the world. A chief inspector from Britain's MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, sat in a leather club chair positioned opposite Carol in the hotel suite. Patrick Fraser was a tall man with thinning pale blonde hair and a pencil-thin mustache. He wore his clothes in a rumpled manner, and he spoke in a cultivated drawl, every word deliberately shaped. Frazier was one of Britain's resident experts on urban terrorism. Physical pain was coursing through Carroll's body as he listened. Yes, you paid your dues every single time with police work. Too much bitter-tasting coffee and unrelieved tension, not enough sleep. Too much being lost and confused without any recognizable point of reference. And the arm still ached like hell, even though he discarded the sling in favor of a bulky bandage. Hours later, the hotel room telephone rang, and Frazier eagerly snatched it up. Ah, Harris. How are you, old man? Oh, we're holding up. I suppose we are. It's for you, Carroll. Scotland Yard. Harry Harris on the other end was speaking very loudly as Carroll took over the line. Harris was from the Yard's Serious Crime Squad. Carroll had worked with Harris twice before in Europe and respected the man. Listen to what we've just found. You're not going to believe it, I'll wager. There's been an incredible turn. The IRA has just contacted us. They want a meeting set up with you in Belfast. You, specifically. They are in the game now, too. In what way? How are the provos involved, Perry? Blood was suddenly pounding in Carroll's forehead. Green Band came at you hard, then they pulled away just as fast. They came at you, then they disappeared again. The second you dropped your guard, bang, right between the eyes. Come to Florida, Mr. Carroll. A clue there? Florida? Go see Michelle Chevron. A key somewhere in Europe. And now the provost. They've come into some securities, U.S. bonds, over $1 billion worth, according to the Boyles. They listed names and serial numbers for us to check in New York. They check. Hold on, wait a minute. Carroll was sitting upright in his hotel chair. The IRA has taken over the stolen securities? I don't know. They're definitely in possession of some stolen goods. But how? Who knows? They're telling us as little as possible, of course. Son of a bitch! They'd come so far. They'd seem so close to some kind of break in the Green Band puzzle. All right. We'll be in touch as soon as we sort out things here. We'll be back to you, Perry. Carroll slammed down the phone receiver. He glared across the London hotel room at Frazier, at Caitlin, whose eyes were suddenly wide open and alert. Somehow, the IRA has made a move into this thing. It seems the provos want to talk about selling some securities back to us. Over $1 billion worth. They know we're in London. How could they know? The question stuck in Carroll's brain like a shriek. And since he couldn't answer it, since he hadn't been able to answer it so far, what was the point in asking it now? How could they know everything ahead of time? Chapter 46. The man called Francois Montserrat, who was wearing a black nylon anorak and a dark beret, and who now walked with a pronounced limp, moved down the Portobello Road in the west of London. He passed through the open market for which this street was famous. Now and then he would pause at this stall or that and examine an antique. There were some very fine pieces to be had here. There were also some obvious fakes. You need a good eye, a practiced eye, to tell the real article from the false, he thought. In the palm of his hand, he turned over a jade piece in the shape of a small link. He curled his fingers around it, squeezing hard. He was not a man who gave way to his emotions easily. In fact, he came at them in a circumspect way, circling as if they were live packets of plastique. At any given moment, an emotion could all too easily explode. Like right now. The sensation coursing through Montserrat was one of cold anger. If the jade link had been fur and bone, the life would have been squeezed out of it. He was angry because he didn't like clever games when they were played by the other side's rules. Green Band, for instance, had become a threat. They created their own rules, their own games. They said one thing, they did another. They suggested important meetings that never took place, They were like air. They were very much wisps and phantoms. Montserrat's admiration was grudging. He set the jade links down and he closed his eyes. He had a trick to guard against emotion. He would retreat into a dark, cool place in the deepest part of his mind, a monastery of silence. In this sanctuary, he almost always had control. Nothing slipped away from him here. This time, though, his little trick of the mind failed. He opened his eyes, and the bustling market assaulted his senses. Greenband was somewhere close. What did they really want? Perhaps soon, he would know all about Greenband. Chapter 47. They had to wait one final time. They had to wait at the tiny, fastidious Regent Hotel in Belfast. Carol tried to accept the helpless feeling that they had no control over anything that was happening. The Green Band strategy, whatever it was, seemed to be working flawlessly. Well-coordinated economic terror, massive psychological disorientation designed to create escalating chaos and even more terror. Patrick Fraser kept up a cheery pep talk under the unusually trying circumstances. The special branch man was tirelessly gung-ho. When we do meet with them, Fraser slid off his wire glasses and briskly rubbed his eyes, you'll be outfitted with an internal transmitter, absolute state-of-the-art, designed for the military. Armalite Corporation, you swallow the damn thing. Carol shook his head. Ah, police work. Sometimes he wondered what he'd thought it was going to be like, long, long ago, when he first decided on what he now sometimes called the wrong side of the law. If we ever do meet up with them, Caitlin will verify that the securities are genuine, Fraser said. If we ever meet up with them. 6 more hours droned by in the most painfully slow waltz time. The only perceptible change was the morning sliding into afternoon outside, the day turning to the steel-blue shades of the northern Irish cityscape. A red-haired serving girl, no more than 16 or 17, finally brought in steaming tea and hot Irish soda bread. Carol, Fraser, and Caitlin ate out of boredom more than anything. Carol remembered to check in with Trent Camp's office in New York. He left a message for Walter. Naught, zero, butkus, zip, goose egg, as in wild goose egg chase. 10 hours passed inside the Regent Hotel suite. It was exactly like what had happened the night of December 4th in New York, when the final deadline for the bombings had gone past, and the clock hands had begun to move with intolerable slowness. Why, though? How were they supposed to investigate a chimera or a mirage? From the fourth-floor window of the hotel suite, Carol saw an antiquated bicycle bumping over the cobblestone street outside. It was ridden by a man of about 70, whose thin frame didn't look like it could survive the shuddering motions of the bike. Carol leaned closer to the dormer window. His brain felt like something shapeless lying in a basin of tepid water. The rider parked his bike almost directly below the Regent Hotel window. Could this be our contact? Carol asked in a hoarse voice. Patrick Fraser moved into the window and studied the old man. Doesn't look the terrorist type. That's a good sign. They never do in Belfast. The rider hobbled inside the hotel entrance, then disappeared from Carol's sight. He's inside now. Then we wait and see, Fraser said, muttering to himself. Carol sighed. The tension buzzing inside him was familiar now. He looked toward Caitlin, who smiled at him. How did she stay so calm? The journey, the tension, the awful waiting. Less than 90 seconds after he went inside the Regent, the old man came marching out again. He rigidly climbed back on his bike. Almost immediately there came a solid rap on the hardwood door of the hotel suite. Caitlin rose and opened the door. An old man just delivered this message, a British detective entered and reported. He walked forward to his commander, passing both Caitlin and Carol without so much as a nod. Patrick Frazier immediately ripped the envelope open and read it without any discernible expression. Frazier's eyes finally peeked over the wrinkled note page at Carol. He read the words of the message aloud for both Carol and Caitlin. There's no salutation or date. It reads as follows. You are to send your representative with a proof of transfer of funds. Your representative is to be at Fox Cross Station, 6 miles northwest outside of Belfast. That's the railroad. Be there at 0545 hours. The precious securities will be safely waiting nearby. The messenger is to be Caitlin Dillon. Chapter 48. At 5:30, the morning air was misty in Belfast. It was the kind of day in which objects have no hard definition. The railway platform at Foxcross was silent. All the trees were stripped and bare and looked arthritic in the wintry absence of clear light. Up beyond the mist, the sky was dark gray and the cloud cover low. Caitlin shivered slightly and folded both arms around her rising and falling chest. She could hear the drumming of her own heart. She wasn't going to let herself be frightened, though. She vowed not to act the way a woman would be expected to act under the circumstances. Caitlin sucked in a raw, cold breath. She shifted impatiently from one boot to the other. No one was visible yet, not anywhere up and down the weathered railway platform. Was it all going to be over after this? Who was Greenband finally going to turn out to be? What part did the North Irish play? And what could have happened between the Russians and Greenband in London? A black leather briefcase hung from her wrist. Inside were codes to release the sums now on deposit at a Swiss bank, which were to be paid outright this morning. The ransom of the century was to take place here at Little Fox Cross Station, historic Fox Cross Station outside Belfast, Ireland. Caitlin imagined she looked like a successful businesswoman with a fine black leather briefcase. Some regular commuter heading into downtown Belfast. Another day at the bloody office. She thought she was playing the part well, on the outside at least. She glanced at her watch and saw it was a few seconds before 5:45. The time they'd indicated for the exchange had come. Caitlin cautioned herself that they were not necessarily punctual. What would their lack of punctuality mean right now? What would it mean in terms of any emergency police action planned for the Foxcross Railroad platform? Caitlin's body tensed. Every muscle, every fiber inside her involuntarily tightened. A faded blue-panel truck had appeared and was approaching the deserted station from a thick row of pine trees to the north. The slow-moving truck steadily got larger and larger. Caitlin saw that there were 3 passengers, all of them men. Then the blue-panel truck passed Caitlin by. A gust of frozen wind swept back her hair, and Caitlin let out what must have been the deepest sigh of her lifetime. Carol and the British detectives were close by, a thought she found more than a little comforting. They were less than a mile away. Still, there was nothing they could do if trouble suddenly bloomed, if someone panicked, if someone made a simple, foolish mistake now. A car, a nondescript sedan, approached moments after the panel truck. Caitlin tried to observe everything about the car as it rolled forward over the parking lot gravel. Very possibly it was just a passenger drop-off for the first scheduled train at 6:04. It was a late-model Ford, grayish-green, with a slightly smashed-in front grille. There was a tiny chip in the windshield. 4 passengers inside, 2 in front, 2 in the back. Irish working men? Thick, heavy-set types anyway. Maybe farm workers? But the second car passed her by, too. Caitlin was both relieved and disappointed. She was confused, trying to keep her wits and remnants of her concentration. Then the car stopped suddenly. The tires screeched in reverse. 2 burly men in back jumped out. Both were wearing black cloth masks. Both carried machine gun pistols. They ran to Caitlin at full speed, work shoes splatting hard against concrete. "You're Caitlin Dillon, Nissa?" one of the masked men asked. He thrust forward his menacing gun muzzle. "I am." Caitlin's legs had begun to slightly buckle. Her knees were suddenly on hinges. You were born in Old Lyme, Connecticut?
I was born in Lima, Ohio.
Birth date, January 23rd, 1950.
1953. Thanks a lot.
The masked IRA terrorist laughed at Caitlin's response. He apparently appreciated a modicum of coolness and humor.
All right then, dearie. We're going to put one of these hangman masks on you. No eye holes for looking out. Nothing to be afraid of, though.
I'm not afraid of you. The other man, the silent partner, looped a black hood over her hair, then pulled it down tight over Caitlin's face. He was careful not to bump or touch any other parts of her body. How very Irish Catholic, Caitlin couldn't help thinking. They put a bullet into her without blinking. She knew that. But no impure thoughts, no accidental touching of a female.
We're going to lead you back to the car now. Nice and easy.
Easy does it.
All right, step up, step inside. Now down and back.
On the car floor here.
There we go, all comfy.
Caitlin was feeling numb everywhere. Her body seemed no longer to belong to her. She found herself saying,
Thank you. I'm fine right here.
Your mom's name is Margaret? Cleverly timed.
My mother's name is Anna. Her maiden name is Reardon.
No tracking device anywhere on your person?
No.
Caitlin had answered a little too quickly, she thought. Her skin went cold. Suddenly she couldn't breathe at all. There was no apparent reaction, nothing she could perceive as wrong from the Irishmen. They seemed to believe her, not even to question what she'd said about the tracking device.
I have to check you all the same. Pat you down. All right, here goes.
Clumsy, male hand.
Mechanic? Some kind of working man? Groped all over her body.
Caitlin stiffly tensed her legs as a man's hand wedged up between. The intruding hand felt very harsh and rude. The worst part so far. Probably not the worst she was going to experience today, though.
If you have a transmitter, we have orders to kill you. If you don't tell us right now.
Don't lie about this theory.
Don't lie, Missy. I'm quite serious.
Do you? Do you have any tracking device?
We'll check you thoroughly as soon as we're out of here.
Please tell me the truth.
I have no tracking device on me.
Inside me? Could they really find that?
There was no more talking after that. The body search ended abruptly.
Caitlin's ears stayed plugged, as if she were trapped in a vacuum. Her heart lodged very high up in her throat. The car's engine coughed and came alive. Someone suddenly wiped her face with a dripping wet handcloth.
Jesus! The fumes were everywhere. The fumes wouldn't let her breathe.
No, I...
Chapter 49
Oh, bugger it. Look at this hopeless mess, Patrick Fraser exclaimed.
Torrents of water jackhammered the Bentley that Carol and Inspector Patrick Fraser were riding in. Rain blasted the steamy windshield, hitting with the solid force of a fire hose. It had begun to spit rain at 5 minutes to 6. Then suddenly it was coming down heavily, piercing the mist, making it nearly impossible to see the road ahead.
They're on the Falls Road now. That's in the rough and tumble part of Belfast, Fraser said. The Provisional Irish Republican Army owns it. It's your basic urban ghetto where they regularly ambush our soldiers. Hit-and-run snipers in there, mostly. Urban guerrilla warfare at its best.
Both Carol and Fraser were hunched forward in the front seat of the Bentley. The transmitter beeper tracking Caitlin was coming over loud and clear. It sounded a little like a sequence of radar blips, all originating somewhere deep in Caitlin's stomach. Carol couldn't help thinking of a heart monitoring device and an intensive care unit, something that registered one's hold on life.
Poor Caitlin. But he couldn't have done anything to stop her from going. He couldn't have offered himself as a substitute messenger. The instructions had been specific and final.
The monitoring blip, blip, blip was becoming louder now, and more stubbornly insistent. The car with Caitlin inside was apparently slowing down. Maybe it was temporarily stopped at a streetlight, in heavy traffic. What now?
Range closing fast, sir, reported the driver.
Hang it, they're at the home base, Patrick Frazier sharply pronounced. His driver immediately stepped down on the gas. The Bentley leaned forward with a thrusting surge of power.
Either that, or they're switching transportation, Carol had another thought.
Carol's mind cocooned tightly around the thought of Caitlin in serious danger. He was both angry and afraid.
Let's get in closer to her. Come on, come on, let's move it now, Carol snapped at the British Special Service driver.
Less than 2 miles away, the black cloth hood was raised up over Caitlin's head. She reeled away as acrid-smelling salts were passed under her nose. Her watering eyes rolled backward.
Huh?
Focus. There were dull-edged silhouettes rather than faces clustered all around her. Three of them. Behind the looming shapes stood excessively bright lamps. Behind the lamps were still more shadowy, unidentifiable figures.
Green band?
She couldn't see who the others were. Not yet, anyway.
Welcome back among the living. You're a brave one to accept our invitation. Probably a little scared right now.
That's natural enough.
Caitlin still couldn't see them very well, even the men standing closest to her.
You do have authority to transfer the agreed-upon sum of money. You have the necessary bank code, Miss Dillon?
Caitlin nodded. Her neck was stiff, her throat dry and itchy.
When she spoke, her voice sounded hollow and lifeless to her, her words clumsily formed, as if she were being spoken through by a ventriloquist.
Would you mind showing me some of the stolen securities? I need some reassurance as well. I need to see what we're getting in the exchange.
You'll be able to estimate the true value by yourself, eh? And you can tell counterfeit from the genuine article? You bet, finely trained an eye.
Touch is more important than the eye, Caitlin said, hiding any anger she felt.
I can tell a great deal by touching the securities, enough to release the money in Geneva.
Please, may I examine the goods?
They finally brought the sample stolen stock certificates and bonds to Caitlin. She used most of her will to hold in a tiny gasp of amazement.
The look of the securities was certainly authentic.
She read off the top names: IBM, General Motors, AT&T, Digital, Monsanto. She played with the numbers in her mind. It was several thousand times the amount of the great train robbery, and who knew how much of the total stolen amount this was? What was coming still?
You can touch the documents all you like, darling. They're real, though. We wouldn't bring you all the way here for nothing, just to chat and admire your fine all-American boobies.
Chapter 50. The Bentley sedan Carol rode in barely slowed as it squeezed around a crumbling white brick wall in the inner city. The wall was blackened in places from petrol bombs. The car's radial tires screeched above bustling city noises. Suddenly, a flatbed truck was in the same narrow, twisting lane as the Bentley. The truck's engine roared, and its horn blared loudly. A blast of gunfire erupted from the cab of the onrushing truck. Spits of gunfire came from the flat tenement rooftops to the right of the Threadneedle roadway.
Ambush, Patrick Frazier grunted.
Almost instantly, he slumped back hard against the car's passenger door. A jagged hole appeared at the center of his forehead. Carol pushed open the door and followed the driver of the Bentley out. Then he lay pressed tightly against the side of the car. He looked up, staring at Patrick Frazier's wound through the open Bentley doorway. Carol angrily swung his gun barrel out in the direction of the flatbed truck. Without any accompanying sound, the weapon opened rapid fire. Gaping bullet holes appeared everywhere on the truck's already mottled surface. One of the Irish gunsels, astonished because there had been no gun sound, blew back away from the faded red hood of the truck. Blood spurted from his black bearded face and throat. And then the body was rolling and rolling across the road, like that of a man trapped in a barrel. Carroll's machine gun pistol had been developed and perfected by the Israeli army. It fired automatically, up to 250 rounds in 6 seconds. The bullets were attracted by body heat. Silent death, the Israelis and their enemies called it. A stout, red-headed man's forehead was angrily stitched straight across with bullet holes. The man performed a brief two-step, then spun off a house's steep shingled roof. Carroll was aware of movement on either side of him. Crowds, mostly women and children, were streaming out of crumbling, low-slung tenement buildings. They mobbed forward instead of hiding away in the safer shadows. They had deep red faces, anger coming from the heart. The two remaining gunmen from the truck dodged back among the women in their plaid bathrobes and tattered men's jackets. They crouched among the dirty-faced children, many of whom were still in their pajamas, dragged out of the innocence of sleep and made to confront still another horror in their young, sad lives. Carroll clicked the machine gun off automatic so it wouldn't fire into the covering crowd. "British spies!" The Irish people had suddenly begun to jeer, protecting their revolutionary soldiers, some of whom were immediate family members, some less close relatives than friends. "Damn British spies! Damn you British! Go home, damn Brits!" Carroll cautiously ran forward anyway. He threw himself into the fierce, snarling faces, the threatening, murderous shouts. His machine gun jutted out, the ugly black snout just menacing enough to keep them off him for the moment. Who was the real terrorist here? His mind rambled.
"Big man with your gun," someone taunted.
"Hooking coward with your machine gun, dirty Brit turd, filthy Brit bastard." Carroll almost didn't hear the angry shouts. He had one thought only. Follow the beeper. Follow the radar blip. Find Caitlin right now. Caitlin covered her head with both arms. She was trying to squirm and struggle away from the IRA men. The air in the tenement room was like liquid mold, almost impossible for her to breathe. "You filthy whore, you! You swine!" The headman screeched at the top of his voice. He screamed inches from Caitlin's face. A contact radio was crackling nearby, blaring the latest street reports into the IRA hideout. "It's a trap! In fucking sane! She's carrying some kind of signal, Dermot. Police cars. Brit soldiers are swarming the street out there. Soldiers are everywhere." It was the most helpless moment Caitlin could have imagined. She knew what they were going to do to her. She knew she was going to be shot, murdered. She wondered when that moment of resigned calm would come, that transcendental moment you were supposed to experience when you understood you were facing death. The IRA group leader continued to scream. His black masked face was up close to her. "You bloody knew!" "No, I didn't know. Please. I don't understand now." The terrorist suddenly lunged forward, propelling himself out of the blinding white floodlight. He ripped off his mask. She saw a dirty, reddish-blonde beard, black hole for eyes. She saw the close-up, gaping mouth of a Russian SKS assault rifle. Tears flooded Caitlin's eyes. She tried to tell the terrorist not to fire, to stop. Her senses were overwhelmed with horrifying impressions. She wondered if this was the way it was going to be. One burst of crazy clarity, and then you're dead. That solitary, heightened moment, the last thing you take with you. There were police sirens and ambulances and gunfire outside. The air was pierced with maddening chaos. Somebody she'd never seen before stood poised with a drawn pistol. A volley of automatic gunfire flared out of the gun aimed into Caitlin's face. It made a roar sound, like a mundane dentist drill. Oh no, oh God no. Caitlin tried to twist and turn away. That one urgent thought stuck in her mind. Get away now. Get away. Get away. Only she couldn't move as fast as the sudden automatic rifle fire. She didn't move an inch off her chair. Then Caitlin simply fell away from it. Chapter 51. Get out of my way! Out of the way, you bastard! Carroll screamed at three men standing in his path. The Irish hoods were stubbornly posted between him and the tenement house stairway. They were waving Gaelic football bats in the dimly lit hallway.
"Why don't you make us move? Come on now, make us move. See if you can."
The tracking beeper was singing desperately, actually vibrating in his jacket vest pocket. Caitlin had to be upstairs. She was right in this building. Police sirens, emergency army sirens were shrieking. Sniper gunfire was still raining down on the Falls Road.
"Move! Now! Move!"
Carol leapt between the three surprised youths. They wisely sidestepped the charging, bull-shouldered American. Carol crashed two and three steps at a time up a twisty flight of darkened stairs.
Please, God, no.
He was fighting against rage, and an even worse fear building inside him. He kept a machine gun clipped off automatic fire. There were civilians swarming inside the tenement house. Apartment doors kept opening, then rapidly slamming shut. Carol felt their wind in his face. There were hostile looks and abusive screams. As Carol finally reached the top landing, the fourth floor of the building, he saw the dingy yellow door of an apartment thrown open. His brain clenched unbelievably tight, filled to exploding with unnatural heat. Suddenly, he knew what he was going to find there. Carol knew it. He could see inside the doorway already. Then he could see her lying there, still in her overcoat. Her striped muffler was off casually to one side. She lay thrown up against the fallen wooden chair where she had apparently been questioned. The IRA henchmen were gone, up to the roof, up over other roofs, gone, escaped somewhere.
"Oh, God, no," Carol choked back a sob, a desperate, hopeless prayer.
He experienced that awful, hollow bitterness of death all over again. He felt terrible hurt from some infinite store of pain. Slowly, then, Caitlin rolled over. She rose just a few inches. Then Caitlin struggled to sit up, and Carol ran forward. Her face was a blank, dazed stare. But she was alive. Carol held Caitlin. He cradled her like an injured child in his arms. Then she suddenly drew her face away from him. She stared at something that terrified her across the room. Carol followed the line of her eyes to an inert shape that lay on the other side of the barren room. The body seemed to be that of a young man, except you couldn't really tell. Half the head had been blown away. The darkish hair was matted with blood. The figure was shrouded with a dark blue uniform of a Belfast policeman.
"Who is he?" Carol asked.
Caitlin slowly shook her head.
"I don't know. I only know that if it hadn't been for him coming when he did, I'd be dead. He came through that doorway. He started shooting at them."
Carol couldn't take his eyes away from the murdered policeman. A hero, Carol thought. A hero with no name or face anymore. Police work in all its glory. Caitlin was sobbing, almost without any sound.
"Now, shh," Carol whispered.
Then Caitlin couldn't help herself anymore. The sobbing became uncontrollable. She cried into Carol's chest. She held him with her remaining strength. They were enfolded that way, holding one another, when the teams of British Special Branch men and Irish police arrived. Once again, Green Band was nowhere to be found. Chapter 52. By the evening of December 12th, the letters, stuffed inside 8x11 manila envelopes, had finally arrived. Over 3,000 bulky letters had been mailed to every region across the United States. The letters had come to the strangest, the most unlikely places. To Sedona, Arizona. To Doran, Alabama. Totowa, New Jersey. Buena Vista, California. Iowa City, Iowa. Stowe, Vermont. Cambridge, Massachusetts, Boulder, Colorado, Scarborough, New York. Kitty Sherwood in Erie, Pennsylvania was one of the chosen few. Sherwood was home from work that day because if he went to the mill, he'd just say something dumb and get his ass either chewed out or fired. For 9 years, he'd been a machine operator with Hammond Tool and Die. He made almost $29,000. 3,500 of which went for shrink sessions with a psychologist in Pittsburgh, little goateed fellow who treated him for his recurrent war dreams. There was a neatly typed cover letter inside the envelope. It looked official, a little scary even.
Dear Mr. Sherwood, during the years 1968 to 1972, you served your country proudly as a specialist in the U.S. Army. You were a POW from January 1970 to June of 1972. You received the Purple Heart in Vietnam. Please consider the enclosed a token of our appreciation for your services, a chance for your country to serve you.
Kenny Sherwood cautiously slid a piece of parchment paper out of the envelope. Now what the hell was this? There was some kind of chained woman holding a globe of the world at the top of the parchment paper. Further down, the certificate said, General Motors Common Stock. The legend went on. This certifies Kenneth H. Sherwood is the owner of 5,000 shares. Tied around the parchment paper was a shiny green ribbon, a kind of green band. Part 2. Black Market. Chapter 53. David Hudson woke with a headache in his room in the Washington Jefferson Hotel. It was snowing outside, the satiny whiteness evenly blanketing West 51st Street. Hudson pinched his wristwatch off the wobbling nightstand. It was just past two. He sat upright and yielded to an uncharacteristic moment of panic. His throat was dry, his hands clammy, his body felt fevered. It wasn't Green Band troubling him this time. Green Band was hurtling along without an apparent hitch. Even at its psychological core, Green Band was moving beautifully, creating uncertainty in all the places where Hudson wanted to create it. It wasn't the time he'd spent in a North Vietnamese prison camp either. The memories of the taunting lizard man had stayed out of his dreams that night. None of these things bothered David Hudson right now. It was something else. Something unexpected and unplanned. It was Billy Bogan. Like the poet Louise. He was angry with himself, disappointed that he let the woman affect him. It was unlike him. It was undisciplined and out of character for Hudson to permit such a distraction before his mission was complete. Yet somehow he felt he could handle it, that he could keep everything in perspective. Or was he fooling himself? Was she going to be the reason he finally ruined everything? The one serious slip-up, his fatal flaw? Would he allow himself to blow Green Band because of Billy Bogan? This woman he barely knew? He needed to see her at least once more, he decided. Tonight, if he could. The most vivid images of Billy suddenly drifted past his eyes. Hudson felt himself aroused. He threw on an old musty shirt and trousers and went down to the lobby. He prowled around nervously, watched by a clerk at the desk. He finally called the vintage service, not wanting to use the phone in his own room. I'd like to see Billy. Tonight, if possible. This is Davis, number 323. There was a pause as he was put on hold. 3 or 4 minutes, which seemed even longer. Billy's not on her beeper. She doesn't seem to be available right now. The answer came back. You can meet one of our other escorts. They're very beautiful. Former and part-time models and actresses, David. David Hudson hung up the telephone. He felt disappointed, unsatisfied, empty in a cold, gnawing way. Maybe he couldn't handle this right now. Maybe he shouldn't ever try to see Billy again. The idea of blowing Green Band over some English whore almost made him laugh. It would be ludicrously funny if it all ended like that. Only David Hudson knew that was impossible. The final Green Band plan was flawless. It was so good, it could work without him from here on. Deception, David Hudson remembered. The very beginnings of Green Band. Deception and delusion that had started as far back as Vietnam. Chapter 54. La Hope Mule Prison, July 1971. Captain David Hudson's tortured, 115-pound frame slumped forward. The fragile shell of his body threatened to shatter into pieces, to collapse in exhaustion or perhaps death. Hudson's mind silently screamed for him to give up this useless fight. What remained of his body was racked by pain, intense suffering that would have been unthinkable before the last 11 months in North Vietnamese prison camp. He was unsuccessfully trying to put his mind somewhere else now. He ached to be outside the seething bamboo hut, somewhere safe and relatively sane in his past, even as far back as his Kansas boyhood. He'd been trained to resist interrogation and enemy brainwashing. Sisyphus, the program was called at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He remembered that now. Sisyphus had prepared him for enemy interrogation, or so the Army instructors had told him. You must put your mind in another place altogether. It had sounded so simple, so coldly, attractively logical as a concept. Now it seemed absurd, infuriating in its stupidity and typical American arrogance. Sisyphus had been another fraud invented by the U.S. Army. The Lizard Man, the North Vietnamese commandant of La Hope Mo, mechanically raised the white stone game marker. He put one of David Hudson's black stones in check. There was a hard clack of the playing piece against the polished teak board. The North Vietnamese prison guards, all dressed in muddy black pajamas, tipped homemade rice wine from long-necked green bottles. They snorted ridiculing laughter at this obvious mismatch of competitors. The prison camp commandant was swift, completely sure of his game move. He was on a different skill level, Hudson understood. According to the rules of Go, the game should have been played with a sizable handicap called Okigo. Should have been. But strict adherence to rules meant nothing here, because this was a place beyond all decency, all logic, all understanding. Y'all play, the lizard man once again screeched. Y'all play now! He seemed to want his victory right now. The cruel bloodletting, the slow death for the loser in the festering jungle swamp just beyond the prison camp. The guards were physical extensions of their leader's personality. They, too, became impatient now, grumbling and growling for faster action. Clack! David Hudson made an obviously ridiculous, almost an arbitrary move on the go-board. He smiled crookedly at the commandant, as if he'd suddenly turned the game in his favor. You play, Hudson snapped. He knew the smile on his face was hopelessly spacey, but he savored the small moment of triumph. The lizard man was momentarily confused. Then he howled shrill, bird-like laughter. The Vietnamese soldiers howled laughter as well. They inched closer to the two players as the commandant made a surprisingly conservative move with one of his white stones. Disappointment etched itself across the soldiers' faces. Here was uncertainty for the first time. Hudson was amazed at the commandant's hesitation. Yow! Lizard Man screamed. Fast play! Yow play right now! Fuck you, asshole! Watch this one! A smile, hollow and incomprehensible, slipped across David Hudson's blistered lips. Once again, he made a bizarre, a seemingly pointless and foolish game move. You play, he said in a barely audible whisper. You play fair, too. The lizard man squinted and studied the exquisite, highly reflective teak board more closely. He gazed into Captain Hudson's bloodshot eyes, then looked down again at the go board. The guards crushed in closer still. This was getting better, more dramatic, finally. A real game was starting to develop. The soldiers began to whisper among themselves. They were like the professional gamblers, the unsavory flotsam always crowded into the fan-tan parlors of Saigon. Something interesting and curious was happening in the game of Go now. Even the camp commandant was confused, troubled by his American opponent, by his seemingly unfathomable move. For the first time, one of the prison camp guards offered a side bet on the American officer. The commandant threw the soldier the most bitter glance. Suddenly then, smoothly and so coolly, as if he was performing an ordinary movement such as lighting a cigarette, Captain Hudson removed the revolver from one of the Vietnamese soldier's dangling holsters. Hudson swiveled back to the straight-ahead position, directly facing the lizard man. Once again, the faint, half-crazed smile crossed David Hudson's blistered lips. Fucker. Miserable shit fucker. A heartbeat later, the revolver thundered. It was like an army field cannon in the tiny bamboo room. White smoke blossomed everywhere around the game table. Unbelievably, the commandant's head flew straight back. Bone cracked hard against the wooden wall's main support post. The commandant's military hat sailed away saucer-style across the smoking hut. A dark hole gushed like slashed fruit in the Vietnamese officer's forehead. The lizard man's mouth dropped open to show broken, ugly yellow teeth. A lathering, pale-white tongue flopped out. David Hudson reflexively fired the service revolver a second time. He fired a third time. He felt like a weary, wildly confused child, playing with a toy gun. Bang! 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 He thrust the point of the revolver directly in the frozen eyes of the guard who had provided the weapon. The man's face shattered. Skull, flesh, bone flew apart. Another Viet Cong guard was shot in the throat. The two remaining guards had dropped their liquor bottles. They were struggling to get out holstered pistols. The next three deafening gunshots tore through one man's chest, pierced the other's stomach, then his heart. The foul-smelling, boiling jungle hut was suddenly a bloody abattoir. Then Hudson was running outside the command hut. He limped badly on legs that felt like they couldn't actually be his. End of Side 4. Chainsaw Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 5, Black Friday by James Patterson, continuing on page 248. He stumbled, scrambled forward on the unfamiliar, unsteady support. His legs were like wooden stilts. Every object he saw seemed part of a blurred, impossible dream. Everywhere he looked, there was harsh unreality. A late afternoon sun flared orange and bright red over the wall of jungle green. Screeching monkeys skittered away from the place of so many gunshots. Insects buzzed between the trees. David Hudson awkwardly weaved back and forth across the exposed exercise yard. He ducked into the thick jungle that kept threatening to swallow up the prison camp and served as a natural barrier to escape for all the prisoners. Hudson lunged forward. He tripped ahead anyway. He had no choice now. Nowhere to go but into the terrifying jungle. He was breathless already, clumsily crashing against trees, against thick, tangled jungle brush. He kept running, faster than he thought possible. Dizziness grabbed and clawed at him. Whirling bright colors came, shivering cold flashes. He kept running, zigzagging forward, vomiting bile like it was exhaust. As the jungle foliage got thicker, the trail became darker than he thought possible. Almost complete blackness less than 500 yards from the vehicle.